Thank you. Please be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in State versus Bristol Hotel Asset Company.
May it please the court, Ms. Susan Vaughn, and Mr. President, the petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Your Honors, the state requests that you reinstate its condemnation suit for two reasons. First, the state made a prima facie showing that Bristol Hotel was served with notice of the special commissioner's hearing. And second, in this case, death penalty sanctions were in no way justified.
How do you get over the hearsay objection?
Your Honor, it's our position that the hearsay objection simply does not apply to a return of citation.
Why not? I mean, it is hearsay, you'd admit.
Yes, Your Honor, I would admit that that it is hearsay. However, there's a long line of cases that hold that the way...
What's the exception to the hearsay rule that you would say apply? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would suggest that the Texas Rule of Evidence 8038 would apply, and under that rule, the return can be considered not hearsay because it should have been admitted as a public record setting forth the activities of the probate court and its duly appointed commissioners.
Well, that's not right. Isn't it clear that the notice is a piece of paper prepared by somebody that's with one of the parties, namely the state?
Yes, Your Honor, but in actuality, the state does end up preparing the notice, but the statute says that is done under the direction of the special commissioners.
Where is it filed in public record?
It is filed in the court in which the condemnation suit is filed.
And you would say if it's filed in the trial court where the suit's pending, it then is a public record?
Yes, Your Honor, in this instance. And I think you have to look not only at the Texas Rules of Evidence, but you have to look at the case law specifically dealing with condemnation.
Well, let me ask you that. If that's the rule, then anything that anybody files in a lawsuit becomes a public record and is admissible into evidence.
No, Your Honor.
Well, why wouldn't that rule that you just proposed apply in that way?
Well, I certainly think that if the holding is based on the Texas Rules of Evidence, that it should be limited to the specific particular circumstance in a return of a citation in a condemnation suit.
Well, this is not a citation. This is a notice of service. Would you agree there's a difference? Citation is issued by the clerk of the court, put in the hands of a sheriff or constable and served, mm-hmm. and then returned. This notice is prepared by an employee of the state of Texas, ostensibly served and then filed.
Mm-hmm. That is true,
and
Your Honor.
There's a case that distinguishes between the two, isn't there?
Your Honor, actually, there are two cases that distinguish between the two, the Rotello case and the Baird case. And for a number of reasons, we believe that those cases should not, in fact, be followed. They make a distinction saying that, in a regular case, a citation is served by a constable or a sheriff, and therefore that's why it is granted regularity. But we believe that the same regularity should be attached to a citation or a service of notice and a condemnation for a number of reasons. First, if you apply the Court of Appeals decision and the Baird and the Rotella decision, it has to be a sheriff or a constable that performs service for their irregularity.
No, we're not saying that because we've also said that this is not a judicial proceeding, it's an administrative proceeding unless and until the objections to the award are made. Therefore, this particular process is not accorded the same level of veracity as a citation issued and served by the clerk, as issued by the clerk and served by the constable.
Well,
do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Well, we've said that, haven't we?
I don't believe that this court has made any ruling specifically with respect to the service of notice, as did the Baird and Rotello cases. And if you apply the Baird and Rotello cases as they are written in the Court of Appeals opinion, then a return of service of citation served by a private process server would also not be entitled to any presumption of regularity. because a private process server to serve a citation only has to swear that they're 18 and that they're not interested in the lawsuit. That's all it requires. They're not an actual officer of the court.
But that is a judicial proceeding, and there are, if I remember correctly, rules that require an order of the court before you can have a private processor served. Is that right?
Yes, there is. That is correct, Your Honor. There is
so they are ostensibly operating under a judicial order with the authority to serve under whatever requirements there are for citation.
Yes, but the requirements are not
so there. You're not willing to recognize the difference between a regular judicial proceeding and the pre-objection procedure in a condemnation case?
Not with respect to the sort of importance that should be attached to the return in a condemnation case. What I think it's important to realize is that the law regarding how service of notice of these hearings has been in effect for over 100 years as to how the notice is actually to be carried out. We are following statute when we serve these notices this way. And I think it's really important that this court consider the case of Soe versus State. That case was cited by the Court of Appeals in support of its opinion, and it's also been cited by Bristol. That case, the court stated the law.
What's the first name on that?
Soe. It's S-A-U-V-E. It's cited in the Court of Appeals opinion and in Bristol's brief. That case was a writ-refused case. Therefore, this court indicated that it agreed with that opinion in all respects.
What year is that?
Excuse me?
What year is this case?
It is fairly recent, Your Honor. I don't remember the year.
Do you have a southwestern site right now?
Not in front of me, I don't, but I can certainly provide that to you after the hearing. Or it is, in fact, in the briefs. But what is important about the Soe case is it states that a return of service of notice of a hearing in a juvenile certification hearing was valid on its face and therefore carried a presumption of the truth of the facts stated on the return and of regularity. And what is important is this was not a regular civil proceeding. This was a juvenile certification proceeding under the Family Code. And under the Family Code, it said that notice of this hearing could be served by any person directed to any suitable person directed to make service by the court. In this case, the person that actually effected the service was a probation officer. There was no.
But once again, we're tied back to the court authorizing the service. And as I believe your opponent has pointed out, that's not what's going on here. In fact, it is usually an employee of the condemnor who is actually doing the service, who is an interested person in the proceeding. Well, and you would agree that that is allowed under the condemnation law.
Yes,
and that's
Your
usually
Honor.
The way it's accomplished.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that that's a distinction between the case that you cite and the present case.
Well, I would point out that in the Soe case that even though the statute said that it was supposed to be served by a suitable person under the direction in court, there was actually nothing in the record to indicate that the court had actually directed this particular probation officer to make the service, and obviously a juvenile probation officer would have an interest in the hearing. But with respect to the way that TxDOT normally carries out its service, certainly in most cases within the state of Texas, it is done according to statute. This service of notice.
But I think the point is that the questions that Justice Baker has been asking you point out the difference between this service and citation as occurs in the course of an ordinary civil proceeding. Mm-hmm. And you would acknowledge that they're very, very much are different, that they are different types of notices, and in fact are accomplished under different authority and by different means.
Yes, Your Honor, I would definitely agree there are differences.
Let me move on then and ask you a question about the service of notice in this case. The service was not even complete. It had a blank on it in terms of who accomplished the service.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct? Is that correct?
Yes.
What is the effect of that? And why wouldn't that be fatal in any instance?
It is our position that that blank has no effect. I believe you have a copy of that service notice in front of you. There is a blank that says by blank. We would suggest to the court that that was merely surplusage. That is a line in which the person doing the service could have actually filled in her own name, which has been done by our servers in some instances to, again, indicate that they were the person that was performing service.
Well, doesn't that mean
it doesn't say
by
that.
Mail or by hand delivery? Isn't it supposed to be? That's what that blank's mm-hmm. for. We don't know by this whether she mailed it on the 17th at 11:25 a.m. or hand-delivered it.
Mm-hmm. No, Your Honor, we do not believe that that was the purpose of that line. And the reason is the...
But you prepared it, didn't you?
Well, let's just... I served it. I, Susan Kelly, mm-hmm. served it at 11:25 by delivering a copy of the same by... Mm-hmm. It wouldn't make sense to say Susan Kelly again. That's got to be by hand delivery or by certified mail return receipt requested or something.
It is true, Your Honor, that also could have been filled into the blank, but it's our position that that too would have been surplusage because the service of notice said it was done by delivery, and there are a number of cases that hold that the word delivery means in person. So the word delivery substitutes for the phrase in person, and this service of notice was in fact sufficient.
Let me ask you a question. To make this process valid, the notice has to be served.
That is correct, Your Honor.
This is not, now is this different than citation to a party which starts a lawsuit? I guess what I'm asking, I'm wondering what all this argument's about. They obviously knew about it before the hearing was held. They didn't show up. They come argue. What does it matter whether or not the trial court admits this notice? All the trial court has to decide whether or not they were properly served, and the trial court can say they weren't, and that ends the case. Or not. Or is the act of notice a substantive requirement as opposed to simply a notice requirement? In other words, we're not here asking whether or not the property owners received notice. We're here asking whether or not the state has the authority by statute to proceed with the condemnation. And so the notice is not a notice question. It's really a prerequisite to the cause of action. Does that make a difference whether or not this piece of paper actually gets into evidence?
Your Honor, we agree with your understanding of this. We believe that it is merely important that the state actually show that all the proper procedural steps have been taken. And one of those procedural steps is actually preparing and serving this notice, and that all we need to do...
So whether or not... But it is... But there has to be... The paper itself is an operative fact. That wouldn't be hearsay.
Correct.
But within the paper... The actual service is another element, and that would be hearsay in that paper.
And to that extent, we believe that it should be treated like the return on a service of citation in a regular civil proceeding. I mean, this issue comes up at the point in time when the case is, in factually, converted to a regular civil proceeding.
But in a civil proceeding, if a party had actual notice and came down to court, the trial court would be deciding whether or not the service had actually been effectuated, so he had jurisdiction over this person. Mm-hmm. But if they don't do their steps properly, they got jurisdiction because they appeared in court. But this delivery keeps them from proceeding on a condemnation, whether or not they had notice of the hearing, I mean, whether or not they had actual notice of the hearing or not. That actual delivery is a prerequisite to maintaining a cause of action.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's our position that we should be allowed, once we get to the trial court, to prove that that delivery was in fact made. That
well, that's your burden under the law, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is, but we believe that a prima facie case is made by the actual introduction of the service of notice, or even by the fact that it's in the record, just as in a regular civil proceeding. And then if they can present at least some testimony to rebut that, and preferably some corroborated testimony, then presumably we would have to bring in some additional evidence to prove our service, like we attempted to do.
Well, now, let me ask you real quickly. If the Court of Appeals opinion were to stand, what happens?
Well,
you just file a new one?
Your Honor, we would file a new lawsuit, but it would be fundamentally a different lawsuit. We had obtained the right to possession of this property. A writ of possession was entered for the landowner. That was taken away from us, and we were retired to return the property. A new lawsuit would effectively be a completely different lawsuit because the date of taking would be some 4 years later. The values would be different. So, and we would have since had to pay over $100,000 in fees and penalties. It would effectively be a different lawsuit.
Well, I guess my question is, couldn't you have decided when the trial court ruled that this was defective, well, okay, let's cut our losses and go ahead and do a new one and get it corrected right now. We can do this right. Rather than put all the, it seems to me that if time has gone by, that was a judgment call on y'all's part.
Mm-hmm. Well, we would have had to go ahead and pay $94,000 in.
So you get a better deal this way.
Mm-hmm. And I think we asked this court really to make a ruling on the law as it should be, because I think the result of the Court of Appeals ruling is all that a landowner has to do is allege that we haven't taken some particular step, and then we have to go find witnesses. The return of service is no good. We actually have to go and find a witness from out of state, possibly, to come in and testify to those facts just merely based on their allegation or their saying, just
well,
prove it.
But you were on notice of this jurisdictional assertion from April of 98, weren't you?
It is true, Your Honor, that they did indicate in their discovery that
in this particular case, the witness was your employee. In where?
In Dallas,
in
Your
Dallas.
Honor. And but that is not always the case. Sometimes people have to be served out of state.
I understand that, but don't we have discovery for those things? You take depositions and things?
Yes, Your Honor, that is true.
And you could have filed a motion for leave for the ability to amend your discovery answers to include that person's name.
Mm-hmm. Well, we asked for leave during the actual hearing, Your Honor. We only realized either Thursday or Friday before a Monday hearing that this witness had, in fact, not been named. It was a mere inadvertence.
You, before you sit down, comment on the Rule 11 agreement, which is pretty well ignored in your briefing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. I believe that this court should not interpret the Rule 11 agreement to basically deny the state any protections under Rule 93.6 or the principles of Transamerican for several reasons. First, because the agreement was not the basis of the trial court's exclusion of Ms.
Well, but
Kelly.
It's in the record and can support the trial court's agreement. Would you
yes.
agree with that?
Yes, I would agree
right,
that it is in
what
the record.
What is the standard of review of the trial court's decision on whether to admit or exclude evidence?
Mm-hmm. There are several other reasons
no,
why.
What is
Excuse
the
me?
Standard of review mm-hmm. of a trial court's decision to admit or exclude evidence?
Mm-hmm. I think that this court can look to other evidence in the record.
No,
that
answer
would
my question first.
It is abuse of discretion,
right.
Your Honor. I'm sorry.
If there's some evidence to support a trial court's ruling that's in the record, can there be an abuse of discretion?
No, but we don't believe that there is any
well,
evidence.
Is the part of the order that's in the record something the trial court could have looked at but not talked about?
Yes, it is possible, but we do not believe that it would support
well, I understand
ruling.
What you might not believe, but it is part of the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then you never, as I could tell, disavowed the statement in that order. The parties agree,
mm-hmm.
plural.
Mm-hmm. That is correct, Your Honor. In the trial court, we did not disavow.
And never asked for it to be set aside or said it wasn't made or anything like that.
No, we did not allege that in the trial court. But there are several other reasons why you cannot rely on that agreement to deny us our basic protections under the discovery rules. By its very terms, that agreement doesn't apply to requests for relief made during the actual hearing. It simply said, don't do this or this up until the time of the hearing. And if you...
Well, when was the date of the hearing?
The date of the hearing was May 24th.
And what did that order say?
Your Honor...
Between now and May 24th.
Yes, it said...
It included May 24th, didn't it?
It said no more witnesses designated prior to May 24, 1999. Yeah. If that agreement, however, Your Honor, is interpreted to not deny the state any avenue of relief under 193.6 or under the principles of Transamerican, then what is going to happen?
Well, I don't understand how this is a death penalty sanction.
Your Honor, the reason
why... What is the basis of Transamerican's statement that it becomes a death penalty sanction? Mm-hmm. What's the underlying principle to that statement?
I believe it is that...
That you've been foreclosed forever to litigate the merits mm-hmm. of your claim. Mm-hmm.
And we have, in fact, I'm not sure that it says forever, but we have, in fact...
Well, it's the order in those kind of cases are usually dismissed with prejudice or take-nothing judgments. Would you agree to that?
That is very likely, Your Honor.
And your briefs concede that this is a preliminary jurisdictional hearing and the merits were never reached, so your merits assertions are still viable. Is mm-hmm. that correct?
It is true, Your Honor, that we can refile this case.
So how can that be a death penalty sanction?
Well, the reason it is a death penalty sanction, because this particular condemnation suit to condemn this piece of property at this point in time when we actually needed it for a road project that we've had to redesign and work around this piece of property, we were never allowed to acquire that property as of the initial date of taking.
Well, that kind of goes back to Justice O'Neill's question. Why don't you just quit in May of 1999 and start over again?
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't, Your Honor, because we believe that the rulings made by the trial court were vastly unfair and very wrong, and that we should not be foreclosed from an opportunity to actually appeal the case.
Let me follow up and ask about unfair real quick. If we were to uphold the Court of Appeals decision, the posture would be that they have no appeal to the district court, right? And the commissioner's award would stand.
The commissioner's award would not stand as a judgment in the condemnation suit, Your Honor. Objections were filed by the landowner, and so the commissioner's award would not stand. What would happen is we would go back. I assume we would have another hearing where we were actually allowed to present Mrs. Kelly's testimony with respect to service, and they could present any evidence that they might have with respect to service. And if the court then decided that service was in fact sufficient, then we would go forward and have a trial on the merits of the value of the property.
At that time?
At that time, yes, Your Honor.
But if the Court of Appeals is affirmed, you pay $100,000 and start over?
Yes. 4 years later, the property values...
no commissioner's award, no nothing. You pay the attorney's fees and the expenses and start over.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you still need the property even though you've redesigned the project?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. Currently, there are fewer frontage road lanes in front of this particular property. Somewhat of a bottleneck, and we're eventually going to have to go back and fix that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. John McClish will present argument from respondents.
If it please the court. Good morning. I am John McClish with Sue Wall. We have represented Bristol Hotel Asset throughout this case. It strikes me that the court is being asked to reverse the judgments of the lower courts, the trial court and the Court of Appeals, because the trial judge abused her discretion by excluding palpable hearsay, by enforcing a Rule 11 agreement that the parties made on the record and that the government never asked to be let out of, and by denying them a continuance in the middle of the trial after they'd already had one continuance, in a case that's a trial to the court that had been pending for 14 months, a case where they had the burden of proof and they had the burden of going forward to trial. Denying them a continuance so that they could try to get out of their Rule 11 agreement after they had announced ready and after the trial had started.
But you knew about this witness and, in fact, had listed the witness yourself in answers to discovery.
I want to be really clear about that because the persons with knowledge of relevant facts and the witness list have been thrown around kind of like they're interchangeable. It's my judgment in my practice, and I believe the court's intent with the new rules that the persons with knowledge of relevant facts and the witness list are not the same anymore. You can't hide who it is that's going to testify for you, and the 300 names of people that have all the relevant facts are now entitled to the other side's witness list. The parties in this case exchanged interrogatories and exchanged witness lists, and it is true that Ms. Kelly was named as a person with knowledge of relevant facts in our discovery responses, along with probably 20 or 25 other people with the state who we happen to know had some connection with the case. We've tried hard to make complete discovery responses and name everybody from the state who we believed from the record and from the depositions that we took and from the discovery we did. We tried hard to name as persons with knowledge of relevant facts everybody that probably knew something about the case. Ms. Kelly was never on my witness list or anybody else's witness list, and I never had any idea that they intended to call her as a witness at trial until they spoke her name.
Oh, but of course you're taking the position that they had to call her.
I've never thought they were going to be able to make their case, Judge. I'll be honest with you. I never thought they were going to be able to make out notice in this case. My clients told me they didn't get notice.
I'm sorry, they told you what?
Did they
testify to that they didn't get it?
I didn't bring a witness to testify to that. I mean, it's real hard to...
Well, it's cited in your brief.
I testified at the trial as to when we had actual notice of the case.
It says, Bristol's designated representative does not recall being served with notice of the hearing. Reporter's record, page 11, 3 to 23. Is that right?
That's where we read the interrogatory response to the court.
So that was Mr. Klein?
Yes.
And he testified he didn't remember?
He testified that he did not recall receiving. He got an interrogatory answer, a sworn interrogatory answer, that he did not recall being served with the notice.
But he didn't say he didn't get it.
No, sir.
And nobody said they didn't get it.
Well, we filed a verified pleading that said we don't believe that we were served with response.
Well, I don't believe I am, and I didn't get it are two different things.
I agree.
Did anybody say at trial or at this hearing, I didn't get it?
No. And I say that in the context of this is a large multinational corporation that has got a lot of litigation going on. Mr. Klein gets probably a lot of things stuck in his hand.
Well, if he told you he didn't get it, why not just say in the interrogatory answer, I didn't get it?
Because he wouldn't tell me that he didn't get it.
He told you that he didn't get it.
He didn't remember receiving this notice.
All right.
But he was unable to say categorically among all the pieces of paper that have been handed to me by somebody, I know for a fact that I did not get this one.
But going to your statement that you had no idea about Ms. Kelly, your position has been that unless Ms. Kelly actually sits on the witness stand, they can't prove that notice was delivered. So as a part of the entire case, you certainly would have known, at least based on your position, that they had to produce this witness. Or not until after the case was tried did you think, well, wait a minute, this notice somehow is hearsay?
I thought they probably needed Ms. Kelly to prove their case when they didn't take Mr. Klein's deposition. They didn't send us an admission. They accepted our interrogatory answer where we said he doesn't remember being served and we don't think he
then
got
let
served.
Let me ask you this question. Do you agree that the piece of paper itself is an operative fact for the purpose of the condemnation? So the piece of paper is an operative fact, is admissible.
The piece of paper has to be in the court's file. I don't know if it has to be admitted into evidence, but it has to be in the court's file to give the special commissioners even authority to go forward.
And so when it was offered in evidence, it was error for the trial court to exclude it.
No, the trial court admitted it as an operable fact, but excluded it as hearsay, okay, the recitation of service contained within it.
All right. So So the only thing here is that you're arguing that there's no evidence as a part of this process that it was served. That's your. We know we had the notice. We know they did what they were supposed to do, but we have no evidence that it was served. And that's the.
I want to be really clear with you, Your Honor. I do not believe the notice was properly served. I wouldn't make a claim that I didn't. I do not believe that the notice was properly served. And the evidence is in the case. The evidence in the trial is that I gave testimony about is that I did not know about this hearing until 1 week before it was scheduled to go.
But
and we found that out by
accident. Doesn't this really come down to Rule 11 agreement? Because the hearing, they didn't have to give notice until 11 days before the hearing. So you're not going to know in time to supplement your discoveries in the 30-day time period who served that notice. So it's kind of ludicrous to suggest that you have to list the name of the person who served the notice in your discovery responses.
The hearing that we're talking about now is one that happens well before
the
hearing.
No, I know, but had this gone forward as scheduled, you would not have had the ability to object to the failure to designate Mrs. Kelly in discovery responses because the statute allows you to serve this within 11 days before the hearing. Isn't that correct?
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. The hearing that I was talking to Judge Enick about, and the hearing and the notice that I'm contemplating is at the administrative stage, long before any discovery is ever exchanged. This was the notice of the hearing to come and present your case before the special commissioners. That's required by the statute to be served 11 days before, but the discovery is not exchanged until the objections are filed and until formal citation, service of citation of the objections is affected by the constable. So the hearing that I was talking about doesn't have any. It happens long before there's any discovery. We're not entitled to know who the names of the witnesses they're going to call, except that we have to trade appraisals now. The administrative hearing is before the courts of powers of the court are ever invoked. The Rule 11 agreement had to do with the discovery that was going to take place on the merits trial for the jurisdictional the jurisdictional proof, which happened 14 months after the hearing before the special commissioners and the objections were filed and served.
And that hearing took place without your client's participation?
Yes, ma'am.
No one was there. You weren't there. No one was there.
No, ma'am. The law is very, very clear that if we show up at the hearing, we waive our right to complain about both notice and good faith negotiations. We were not willing to make that waiver because we believed that we had to claim. We're obliged. Connie Mee is obliged to stay away from the hearing if you want.
How do you respond to their argument that if we allow the Court of Appeals opinion to stand, it's going to put them in a horrible box in every case that an objection is made to the service? They're going to have to call people in from out of town. How do you respond to that? Which seems to be the reason they brought it here, is to get some broader principle that they don't have to go to that effort.
I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that the case may really be moot, and that may be the only reason it's here. But let me say that this has been the burden that has been on Texas condemnors since at least 1880.
Do we have any cases before Barrett and Rotella?
Yes, sir. Both sides have cited cases that go back before there was a Southwest Reporter. I mean, there's cases in Texas reports.
That this is not admissible in evidence, doesn't stand on its own.
That says the government has the obligation to prove that they gave written notice to the landowner, timely
fashion. Yeah, well, but how you do that?
No,
is
that's
there
right.
Any case other than Barrett or Rotella?
And the city of Houston versus Kinsey to a lesser extent, which is an opinion of this court, where they had the service made by a constable. The service of notice was made by the constable, and they tried to bootstrap the fact that a constable had made the service in the administrative level into saying that the court should, for the first time, read into that return the presumption of its validity and excuse them from making a proof otherwise.
Well, are you saying then that before the state proceeded with the administrative hearing, the state was aware that you were going to take the position that there was a problem with the service and with the good faith of the negotiations?
The evidence shows that there was.
So you all didn't get your position is that your client does not recall getting the required notice, but you all did find out about the hearing beforehand and chose not to participate because of the notice problem and the good faith negotiations issue, and the state was aware of that and chose to proceed with the hearing at that point in time.
The evidence in the case is that I called the government's attorney when I found out that the case was set and said, I believe there's a jurisdictional problem. If you will put the case off so that we can, if you'll put the commissioner's hearing off, reschedule it for up to a later day from a month or two, so that we can have a fair chance to get up to speed on this case and we can join the issue, we'll show up at the hearing and waive our jurisdictional challenges. And they weren't interested in that. That's the evidence that's in the case, and that's, I will tell you that that's.
I'm not sure I heard an answer to my question. Is it that there would be no way to remedy it, and therefore they have to bring a live person every time this issue comes up?
I occasionally represent the condominor. Most of the time, I represent the landowner. We always try to get this information if there's a challenge by an admission or by an interrogatory, and if the answer comes back you didn't serve us. Obviously, we are aware of the fact that there's a problem, and we try to take whatever depositions are necessary to ascertain whether there really was a problem, whether they really didn't get served. Certainly, I think it would be prudent of the condemnor to always name the person.
Let me make sure I understand, because I understand your argument is it's the condemnor's burden to show notice. So the condemnor would then send out requests for admissions in every case?
So you got served with this notice at least 11 days before the hearing.
So it's that easy, and this argument that the sky's falling and they're going to have to bring somebody in for every case, it just doesn't hold up.
Well, I take it as a serious threat in the rules that if I don't admit facts that are not in serious dispute, that the court should tax against me and my client the other side's costs in going to Dallas and taking the deposition to prove that the fact of service is in fact true.
But if they say deny, then you're putting them to their proof, and they would have to bring in a live witness.
Which is exactly what we would have done in this case.
But if they just say they don't remember, then what?
Well, I think they'd have to bring their note at that point, at least, that they need to bring their witness who remembers, who says, yeah, I served him, and this is when, and this is how.
Well, let's get back to the presumption. Isn't it correct now that constables and sheriffs are not the only people nowadays that serve citations? There's a whole host of people who are not constables or officers of the court who serve citations.
Yes.
Why is that any different when the statute specifically says any person who's competent to testify can serve this notice? How is that materially different from citation issued by someone who's competent to testify?
I think it's because of the nature of the way that condemnation practice goes, but in specific, although there may be many people besides the sheriff or the constable that are now authorized to go and serve process, each of those persons is qualified by and acting as an agent of or on behalf of the court. And they're one of the things they have to do is swear
they're
that they're not interested
runners,
in anything.
A lot of cases, aren't they? They're people that the court reporter hires from college, or they're not officers of the court.
But they take an oath, and they take an oath that they're not interested. That they don't care, that they don't have any dog in the fight.
If the legislature says as a legislature, it's okay to have any person who's competent to testify to serve this notice, why shouldn't we give that equivalency to our rule that says, or the legislature rule that says anybody basically can serve these citations?
Because the person that actually serves the citation in practice and the way that it goes is always them. It's always somebody who is an employee of one of the parties.
As long as the legislature says that's okay, why should we quibble?
Well, maybe we should change the rule of law so that we say we're going to give those returns of service that are made by interested persons and not subject to the court's direction, we're going to give those the same presumption of validity from now on that we have previously given the return of service by a constable in plaintiff civil litigation. But that would be clearly contrary to the controlling law that existed when the trial judge made her ruling in excluding this document as hearsay, in which she refused to give it those.
But all these cases are presumptive validity. The sheriff before the law changed. So those old cases talking about constables and sheriffs were decided way before the law. Now that's just about anybody serving a citation.
I would just say to you, it seems to me that in extending the group of people that the that can actually serve process in a civil litigation. As I read that legislation, the legislature was pretty clear to keep one requirement in there, which is you're only eligible to do this if you're not interested in the litigation. You can't be an interested party and be serviced.
They specifically said in another statute that in these types of cases, you can serve the notice as long as you're competent to testify.
That's right.
Their call.
That's right. And I would suggest, I agree with the Court of Appeals on this. I think that the qualification of you must be competent to testify might be telling Condon or something, which is not only must you be competent to testify to serve this citation, you better be ready to testify. If the landowner comes in and files a verified denial that he didn't receive the
just
the
on the record, you say,
has he? I mean, let me be clear about this. Did he file a verified denial? He did not receive.
No.
Well,
no,
you keep saying this, and it troubles me because you keep saying he didn't get it, and then you keep saying, well, we don't really know whether he did or he didn't. And then you say, well, we believe he didn't, but nobody will ever say he didn't. So which is it? He didn't. Did he ever say, did anybody ever say, we did not get this notice?
The record says he does not recall being served, and he does not believe that he was served.
All right.
And just so I'm clear, the controlling authority that the courts couldn't go against was a writ dismissed case from the Houston First and a no writ case from the Houston First.
I think that City of Houston versus Kinsey, which is one of your cases, says the same thing, which is...
And that would control, you think?
Which is that the condemnor may not look to recitations in the award of the commissioners or the other documents in the court's file for proof of jurisdictional facts when those jurisdictional facts are in controversy, because those documents are hearsay. They're out of court, brought in to prove the truth of the matter asserted where it's in controversy. And where it's not in controversy, I can understand treating the constable's return or the sheriff's return as a business record and getting it in, but not where it's their records, not where it's their...
And you thought all along they wouldn't be able to prove service and get to first base.
We didn't think it happened.
So I don't mean this with any disrespect, but how did you end up at $92,000 in attorney's fees? They never were getting even...
There's evidence on that, Your Honor. There is evidence on that. The case went... I'm the guy that tried the Hip case and the Dowd case, as you may recall, and that's the one where the Austin Court of Appeals, I think, very wisely said, we're not going to try these jurisdictional issues along with the Value case anymore because that's wasteful and that's silly. Let's go have a jury. If we're going to have a challenge of jurisdiction, let's have it up front. Let's have it soon so the parties don't have to spend a lot of money getting ready for a Value trial. At the same time, if jurisdiction is going to be defeated. And the record shows that we tried hard, even though it's their burden to come forward to trial, we tried hard to get this thing tried. And they didn't want to come to a jurisdictional trial. We finally got it tried on the fourth setting, and we said it every time. I mean, it's not like we were dragging our feet and cranking the crank to run up the attorney's fees. We just really didn't have much choice but to prepare parallel Value cases and jurisdictional cases because the case had gone on so long. It was reaching the point where it was close to the limit even for the jury merits of the administrative rules for how soon cases should be disposed of. It's 14 months old when we finally got the jurisdictional trial.
Well, you said earlier that it sounded to you the case might be moot. You're not giving up the $94,000 in attorney's fees.
I don't think that my client should have to give up the $94,000 in attorney's
fees. But I mean, that's still at stake.
Yes, sir. And I did not. I meant no disrespect by saying that the case has been moot and it's outside of the record, doesn't belong here. But I think they finished the road, and I think she's kind of admitted as much.
Any other questions?
Thank Would you like the cite on the case?
On Coons?
On Sobey?
Yes. Thank
you. Oh, yeah, I saw that in
638 Southwest 2nd, 608.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Honors. First, I would like to address a couple of comments made by Bristol's counsel in this case. Bristol makes a distinction between witness lists and naming persons with knowledge of relevant facts. The fact of the matter is they never asked us for a witness list. All they asked us for was to name persons with knowledge of relevant facts. And we did inadvertently, we said this at the hearing that we forgot, we did not name Mrs. Kelly. This was a person that they knew about. They knew about it, they named her themselves, they knew about it because her name was on the service of citation. They knew about it because we turned over that document in discovery.
But isn't there a law that says you can't just cross-designate someone else's list of people with relevant facts and say, well, we're going to file our own and supplement whatever they've listed? I mean, the law is clear. You can't do that. If you want to call somebody, you have to list them, don't you?
Generally, it's important that you list your own witnesses, Your Honor. But the question is whether we're entitled to the relief under 193.6. And there are actual cases decided by the Court of Appeals where they have held that there is no unfair surprise or unfair prejudice in the particular situation where the opposing party actually listed the witness. And so while we're not advocating this as a regular practice, and
what cases are those?
That is Rutledge versus Stainer. A couple of days ago, I filed a short supplemental letter that listed these cases. They're very new cases out of three courts of appeals, Elliott versus Elliott, and the Best Industrial Uniform Supply Company. I would also point out that contrary to the assertion made by Bristol's counsel, there were no cases before Baird and Rotello saying that the return on citation in the condemnation case was hearsay.
Why is that helpful?
The only thing, Your Honor, the Kuntz case says that the state cannot rely on recitations in the award
list of people with relevant facts and say, well, we're going to file our own and supplement whatever they've listed. I mean, the law is clear. You can't do that. If you want to call somebody, you have to list them, don't you?
Generally, it's important that you list your own witnesses, Your Honor. But the question is whether we're entitled to the relief under 193.6. And there are actual cases decided by the Court of Appeals where they have held that there is no unfair surprise or unfair prejudice in the particular situation where the opposing party actually listed the witness. And so while we're not advocating this as a regular practice, and
what cases are those?
That is Rutledge versus Stainer. A couple of days ago, I filed a short supplemental letter that listed these cases. They're very new cases out of three courts of appeals, Elliott versus Elliott, and the Best Industrial Uniform Supply Company. I would also point out that contrary to the assertion made by Bristol's counsel, there were no cases before Baird and Rotello saying that the return on citation in the condemnation case was hearsay.
Why is that helpful?
The only thing, Your Honor, the Kuntz case says that the state cannot rely on recitations in the award or in the judgment, that there actually has to be some proof. But it does not say that the proof can't be a valid return of service. It simply says you can't just put it in the award that the person was in fact actually served. And I'm not sure if I remember the facts of Kuntz correctly, but it seems
isn't
to me...
But actually, isn't that a fundamental principle of if the judgment recites that there was service, then that establishes there was service? I mean, isn't there some authority out there that says that there is some substantive power to the recitation and judgment that the party was served? And wouldn't Kuntz, if it says that this judgment is not entitled, the judgment and condemnation that recites service is not entitled to that same sort of power, doesn't that mean there's a notice in a condemnation case is a something different than a notice in a regular lawsuit?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because I think that in a regular lawsuit, if, say, if it comes up in an attempt to reverse a default judgment, the court has to actually look to the record and determine that there's a valid return of service, that just the statement in the judgment itself isn't sufficient. And I think that's something similar to what the court was doing in the City of Houston versus Coombs case. But there are a long line of cases, and they're all cited in our briefs, specifically saying that the way you prove up all of these procedural steps is to actually introduce into evidence all of these documents, including the service of notice and the return. And Baird and Rotello were contrary to those cases, and this court could not have even reviewed the Baird and Rotello cases because they were appeals from the denial of a temporary injunction. So this court had no jurisdiction to consider those cases and determine whether the law in those cases was correct, and that's why one of them is a no writ and the other one was writ dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. It's also too important to note that there has in fact been absolutely no evidence introduced in this case that Mr. Klein did not receive service. What Mr. McClish is referring to as evidence that he did not remember is simply allegations made by Mr. McClish during the hearing. And these are not actual evidence. There is absolutely no evidence in this record.
What's wrong with the construct they propose of all you have to do is send requests for admissions? And then that will either take care of the problem or alert you that you need to be there with someone with evidence of notice. Mm-hmm.
If you look at the facts of this case, presumably any landowner could allege that they didn't remember and therefore put us to the burden of providing someone to provide live testimony.
Well, I'm a little confused. Your argument assumes or has the premise that a plea to jurisdiction for failure to properly serve notice is an ordinary and regular thing that appears in every condemnation suit. Is that correct?
Oftentimes we get very general pleas to the jurisdiction on all bases because I think that they take the position that because we have some burden that they can put us to the proof on everything.
I guess
that's not entirely unusual in our jurisprudence system, is it?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
But as I understand, if they do appear and participate in the condemnation proceeding itself, the administrative proceeding, then they can't challenge jurisdiction when they come to the judicial proceeding.
They can't challenge the alleged failure for the state to make a bona fide effort to agree. But I think they probably still could challenge the jurisdiction based on notice.
It seems to you, then you disagree with him then about that. You think that if they participate in the proceeding, the administrative proceeding, that they can still come forward in the judicial proceeding and say that the statutory prerequisite of notice was not met, and therefore the commissioners were without jurisdiction to proceed.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe Bristol cited some case law to that effect in its brief.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the second call.